ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Charismatic, rich, stylish, glamorous. Christopher and Pixie Skase were the it couple of the 80s.
Getting an invitation to a Skase party was prized real estate.
But when their business empire teeters, it's Pixie who pays a massive price.
A sort of gilded cage that she was a prisoner in.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've ever driven in Sydney, you'll know it's a maze. There's lanes that vanish, there's roads that change names mid-term, and there is traffic that laughs in the face of logic. Now imagine an autonomous car trying to make sense of that. In San Francisco, Waymo's driverless taxis are already a common sight, and testing is underway in New York. But now the company's in talks with Australian regulators about bringing their robo-taxis here. Could an AI really handle our chaotic streets? And what would that mean for drivers and jobs and safety? This is your guide to the week in technology and culture. My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Our guests this week are two very smart people who can help us navigate the detail of all of this. We have Eric Mealy, Senior Lecturer in Computer Science at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Welcome back, Erica.
Thanks for having me back.
And Michael Cowling, who is Professor of Computing Technologies and Director of RMIT University's Apple Research Hub. Welcome back, Michael.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
Now, Waymo is the company that calls itself the world's first autonomous ride-hailing service, and it's completed millions of driverless rides in the US. Now they're reportedly in discussions with Australian transport regulators about a trial here, including lobbying activity and a possible setup in Sydney, which raises for me a lot of problems. So let's start with, what exactly is Waymo proposing here in Australia? How does it compare with its operations in the US? Michael?
Look, it's all a bit rumour mill at the moment. They've only suggested that they have been lobbying the New South Wales government. But the basic idea is that they're looking to introduce a self-driving car in Australia in some capacity, a robo-taxi, as it were. And the idea is that they've done this in the US, most famously in California and various other states in the US, and they're looking to replicate this in Australia. And it's not unusual for us to start thinking about self-driving cars. Here in Australia, we've recently had Tesla introduce their full self-driving mode as well. So we're starting to think about cars driving themselves.
So who exactly is it that governs trials of autonomous vehicles in Australia?
So it's done on a state by state. States manage roads is what we always say, right? And that is true for self-driving cars as well. So in this particular instance, they're looking at starting, as you said, in Sydney. And so it's the Department of Transport in New South Wales.
I just imagine an autonomous vehicle trying to navigate Sydney. And it honestly makes me laugh a little. Erica, how ready are our laws and regulations and our streets for something with no human driver?
I have long maintained that it's going to be a shock to our system. And in fact, we had the head of RACQ come out and talk to us a while ago, talking about just the limitations on what us as Australian drivers expect. Like, we love that idea of getting out our great car and going for a drive up the coast or down the coast. And I remember when they first brought over the BMW i3, someone said, well, you know, can I drive Brisbane to Sydney? And they looked at us like, we had five heads. And why would you do that? Why would you drive for 12 hours straight? And it's like, because
that's what we do.
It used to be cheaper than flying. So that's what we did. And he's like, well, no, you can drive 3 hours and then charge it overnight. We're like, yeah, that's not going to cut it. But the bigger problem, I think, is intermingling between the driverless cars and the drivered cars, because we saw how it sort of could work in San Francisco. And the best time in my opinion, how it ran over there was that late night kind of get the drunk drivers off the road. And that's when there's not a lot of other people on the road. So it will be interesting to see. But as someone who used to have an hour plus commute on a highway that was pretty cruisy driving, I reckon that'd be fabulous, you know, being able to do something else. But I don't know that I would have the trust to be able to actually take my hands off that wheel. Mm. So I think it's not just the regulations, it's also the drivers themselves. I don't know if the next generation are going to be keener on this, but certainly the older generations, I don't think, are going to have any trust in these autonomous cars.
There is definitely a psychological shift that's needed. And it's really interesting when you talk to someone from San Francisco, they're so used to this. It's so incredibly normal to just hail a Waymo and jump on in. It's completely normal. They've adjusted to it really quickly. Historically, Australians, we've been early adopters of technology. We're usually pretty keen to try out the new latest things. I'm curious as to why Waymo would choose Australia. Do you think that it does have something to do with that mentality of early adoption, Michael?
Look, I think you're right. And I think historically we are early adopters. Cell phone adoption or mobile phone adoption is very high in Australia. So Silicon Valley probably looks at Australia and goes, oh, we would be interested in adopting this technology. But I think Erica is right. I think the Australian roads are a little bit different. And I think the packed sort of dense city streets of San Francisco probably are different to what you're sort of implying about the streets of Sydney. And also those journeys between cities and between suburbs as well. So I'm not entirely sure that it's going to translate as well as Waymo thinks it is. And that's because I think technologically these things still have a way to go. And I think it's noteworthy that Erica highlights that it's the quiet streets, it's the well-worn roads that are really where these cars do best, because they're not really quite at that stage where they can navigate any situation.
I just find it really interesting to focus on Australia, especially considering, like you said, Erica, our really strong car culture. You know, it's something that we enjoy doing ourselves. Even there was a massive amount of backlash against electric vehicles in Australia because we love the sound of the engines and, you know, just getting out there.
I think the other challenge that Waymo may want to be looking at as well is, I remember talking a while ago about the challenge of Australian wildlife, because particularly with our road trains that run, say, across the Nullarbor or some of those, that would be ripe for sort of an autonomous vehicle, except that we have some darn fast, darn unpredictable animals, particularly our kangaroos, that can jump out in front of these vehicles. And I think that's something that's going to be so foreign. Even in, you know, residential Brisbane, you'll have ibis and bush turkeys and things that'll come out, or possums at night. And I don't think they have that in metropolitan San Francisco. So it could also be we've done the easy case, let's try the hard case and find out all the things that are wrong with it, which is a very, I think, tech mindset. Let's take the hardest one and make it work there, and then maybe we can find some of these more intermediate ones after we've sorted out the really hard stuff.
I do think there is sometimes a bit of a gross underestimation of what Australia is like. I think that for Waymo, they might be looking at it as just a very city-centric service that they're offering. But yeah, even talking about the wildlife, I'm thinking if they're putting autonomous vehicles going across the country, once you hit some of the outback areas, you're also dealing with camels, millions and millions of camels, and you're dealing with buffalo as well. How would the systems respond to that?
Historically, very badly. I believe the kangaroo-based research project, they actually ended up saying, we can't do it. They bought over the equivalent software for like deer and moose from North America, and it just couldn't keep up with it. They were too fast and too unpredictable, and it was like, this is too hard for the AI. Mm. So it's an interesting one, and it's certainly something that I think will need trained models. So we'll need to have some of that Australian vision to be able to go, well, this is actually what it behaves like. Because assuming that a kangaroo is going to behave like a deer is probably a very bad assumption.
So speaking of, you know, safety, the liability issues, who does it lie with when the driver is an AI system? At the moment, who is responsible if there's a crash in a Waymo?
So one of the interesting things about Australia is that a lot of our laws are a little bit unclear about this. They're a little bit old-fashioned and they presume that a human being is driving the car. And so when those laws get upgraded to a robot or a machine driving the car, people are not entirely sure what that's actually going to mean in terms of liability. And this is actually something I talk to my students about all the time. It's one of those curly ethical issues that I bring up in my ethics class. If a car is driving and it runs into somebody, is it the car that's responsible or is it the human being? Or maybe it's the developer of the software in the first place, in this case, Waymo. And I think in Australia, where we're not particularly well equipped to think about that question, it's actually, I think, one of the blockers to Waymo bringing it to New South Wales.
Absolutely. I think particularly if we lean into the engineering side, I know in hardware engineering cases, generally you would have to have an accredited engineer sign off on a hardware system. So we're talking autonomous trains, which we do already have running in the Pilbara. That's signed off on by a professional engineer and it's their neck then, metaphorically, that would be on the line. So if it's developed overseas, are they going to have it recertified in Australia? Does it that then become that engineer? And I don't know many engineers who would be willing to sign off on someone else's work that they don't fully understand and put their professional accreditation on the line. So it's definitely one of those questions. And like you, Michael, we do have a course and a class on that in my ethics class as well. And we go back down to even the motivations of the developers. Like, is it a Gasmov's, you know, kind of do no harm to humanity programmed car, or is it a capitalist programmed car that wants to sell spare parts? Like, what was the motivation of the developer? And I think measuring that AI and taking the temperature of that AI is super important, because that they are using AI and machine learning in these. And so the motivation and the bias has to be really well documented, I think, and verified. And I think these learning systems that update themselves are going to be a huge risk and a potential problem for how we run things over here already.
So realistically, how far away are we really from seeing Waymo robo-taxis in Australia? You know, they're saying potentially any time from now through to 2027. Is that plausible? Are we looking more like 2030, 2050? What do you both think?
I look in my crystal ball. I do think that 2026, 2027 is probably a little bit ambitious. Maybe on a small scale, maybe, although as you've said a couple of times, why start in Sydney? That seems to me it would be quite tricky. Even within the city, Melbourne maybe a little bit easier, I don't know. But I think definitely if you were to ask me to just guess, I would say more like 2030, just because of the technology limitations and the different Australian environment. And as Erica said, all of those rogue kangaroos that jump out in front of you.
What do you think, Erica? When might it happen?
Oh, look, I didn't see ChatGPT coming, so I don't trust my crystal ball anymore. Because if you'd asked us 2 years ago if we'd be here, I don't think we would have said yes. Really short term seems unlikely with the barriers that are in place. But we now have a social media ban that came about in less than 12 months. So when our leaders are motivated, sometimes things can happen really quickly.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Erica Mealy, who is a senior lecturer in computer science at the University of the Sunshine Coast, and Michael Cowling, who is professor of computing technologies and director of RMIT University's Apple Research Hub. And Elon Musk's AI company, xAI, has launched an online encyclopedia called Grokopedia. It's powered by AI, and the founder says it corrects perceived bias in the commonly used online encyclopedia, Wikipedia. Erica, what is Grokopedia exactly? Can you tell me how it works?
Look, it's not a place I would dare set my foot, to be honest. And Grok doesn't have the greatest of track record. I mean, it was pulled down for talking about Mecha Hitler, right? So, and my question is, it's correcting what? Whose perspective is it wrong in? Because there's a lot of information on the web at the moment that's being put out there by people who aren't an expert in the space. And, you know, we started that in the, you know, that pandemic that we don't like to talk about. But people would ask me, you've got a PhD? And I was like, yeah, not in anything to biological or medical. Like, I will go to the person who has that training. But on the internet, all voices seem to be equal. And so whose actual moral compass are we using? That's really my question. The power of Wikipedia is there's so many voices. It's not just one voice. So I don't dare set foot in there. So I'm probably not the best to ask.
Michael, say I've decided to fire up Grokopedia because I'd like to get an alternative view on what the truth is. What does that look like?
Alternative view on the truth is 100% correct. Yes. it almost feels like trolling by Elon Musk. But the boilerplate pitch is that Grok is an artificial intelligence tool that generates content similar to ChatGPT or something else. And so Elon Musk's idea is that can we not use these tools to generate an encyclopedia? And his pitch, I guess, is that the bias will be gone from those encyclopedia entries, whereas he thinks that Wikipedia has, let's be honest, a Democrat sort of left-wing bias. He hopes that Grokopedia will have that more neutral tone because the entries are generated by this generative AI tool. But what people have discovered, even in the first few days of it coming along, is that we still have all of those hallucinations. We still have all of those issues with it having things on the pages that are simply not true. And of course, the other issue is that we have to deal with the fact that the generative AI has generated that content from the web. And so it is providing equal weighting to experts, but also to the common man. And so you end up with this strange balance that isn't on Wikipedia, because in Wikipedia's case, even though it's edited by anybody, often the experts are the ones that sort of have a little bit more control and a little bit more desire to make sure things are right. And that's not true when the content is generated by generative AI.
I think that is something distinctive that needs to be called out. You know, when you go to Wikipedia, those pages are edited by real humans, by people. And I know that Wikipedia started its life on the internet as being a source that you should not trust. However, throughout the years, it has become a place where you can go, you can see where the sources come from. You know, people are very passionate about making sure that this is an accurate place that is a real resource for the internet. So Grokopedia doesn't have editors, am I correct?
It's all a little bit opaque in how they actually generate their pages, and people have been doing some deep diving into various different pages on Grokopedia and often noticing that the page is a direct copy of the Wikipedia page. I guess the generative AI thought that was the best source to use to generate its content. But yes, the basic idea is supposed to be that there's not that editorial team, which, as you highlighted, is so important for Wikipedia, because I would often say to my students, look, I think Wikipedia is a great grassroots source to learn about something because it's so curated by so many individuals just making sure that it is correct. And so I think you're right. I think it's grown from that untrustworthy source that it was in the early days of the internet to actually a really good source for sort of grassroots basic knowledge.
I'm also thinking about how this can influence the broader information ecosystem online. You know, trust in online sources is eroding. There's so much misinformation out there. We've got a monopoly of platforms. What does bringing an AI-generated encyclopedia that is trained on an inherently biased AI, what does that do to the internet?
I think it's a symptom or a result of a broader problem that I think we've been dealing with for 20 years, which is that information literacy is going down. And that trust of the common man of anything that you see on the internet has been growing to the point where now it's very difficult for a lot of individuals to evaluate what they read and determine whether or not it's something they should trust or not. I often talk about it being a post-truth society where we need to really sort of very carefully evaluate these things in terms of information literacy. And I wonder whether this, Grokopedia and more broadly generative AI, is the tipping point where we as a society sort of decide that this is something we need to focus more on, which is exciting for all of our librarian friends out there because they're big into information literacy.
And they've been pushing back about having to be online for so many years now. But yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And I also wonder if there's a bit of a generational element to it. And we get quite a lot of return to study folks in some of my courses. And it is so fascinating to me to look at what my mature age students will see as a reference versus what my ones who've come straight out of high school. The number of How Stuff Works and geeksforgeeks.com and medium.com that I got in some of my things, I'm like, come on, really? Like, okay, you didn't use the AI, but this is worse in some aspects. Probably what's being fed into the AI. But I think there is this, it's online, it must be true, naivety that we're seeing in our younger populations. And goodness, I don't know how we fix that in this hyper-online world. We really do need, I guess, that real acceptance of, you know, primary sources and going back to what was the truth, who is the expert, and how do we weight that in this massively online space we're in?
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Rae Johnston here with you. And I've got on the show today Erica Mealy, Senior Lecturer in Computer Science at the University of the Sunshine Coast, along with Michael Cowling, who is a Professor of Computing Technologies and the Director of RMIT University's Apple Research Hub. And did you know there's a dating feature within Facebook? It has quietly become a bit of a surprise hit. There are reports that it now has over 21 million daily users. That means it's outpacing apps like Hinge. So, Erica, why is Facebook dating doing so well?
Look, this is really interesting to me because admittedly I am a single mum and I am part of a couple of communities, groups that are on there. But I think part of it was I didn't even know that Facebook had its own dating thing. There's a lot of people who use regular Facebook for dating. I think I described it in my email to you with so much ick. it's interesting. And the way that this has come about is also fascinating because it was employees within the company who went, hey, people are already doing this on the platform. Why don't we make it a product? Which was much like how Marketplace allegedly started as well. Mm. So it's an interesting one, but there's also talk of how AI can help you get a better date. And I don't know. I think we've said enough this time. Don't trust the AI. I feel like we've got that same message on repeat today. But the idea that we're going to use this artificial show of what we're like in social media to help find dates or partners. Look, I don't know how that's going to go in the long run, but yeah, it's not actually officially available in Australia, which begs the question, why not us?
Yeah, right. So who is actually using Facebook dating, Michael?
Look, I think the short version is the reason that this has become so popular is because of old people. If you ask my kids, they would tell you.
Wow. Are you calling me old, Michael?
Define old in this context, Michael.
Older people. People in their 30s or in their 40s. If you asked my kids about Facebook, they would say none of their peers and their teenagers use Facebook, right? So I think it is partly about the familiarity of the tool. People don't want to get onto the newfangled apps of the world. See, I don't even remember the name of them.
I was going to say, Michael, you sound pretty old yourself at the moment.
the Tinders of the world, right? So instead they lean into the familiarity of Facebook as a tool. And I think it is something that people use Facebook for anyway, that connection with people who aren't necessarily your friends, but just people that you know loosely kind of enables you to use it as a romantic or a dating tool as well. And I think older people, how about that, have a tendency to like to use this tool. And then, of course, as Erica said, Facebook has introduced some interesting AI features into their tool as well.
And look, we're laughing about it now, but I think Facebook, out of all of the social media platforms, probably knows the most about us. I think Meta has the most data collated on us, probably only second to Google. So what are the privacy and data implications when a large social network is using all of your relationships, your preferences, your behaviours to match you. Has the horse bolted on that? Is this something that's just useful to us at this point?
Yeah, no. I hate how much information is known about everybody online. I genuinely dislike it. There is so much profiling that can be done, and there's so much harm that can come from the profiling that can be done. And we're not going to think that the tech companies are going to have our best interests at heart, really. We're a product, and, you know, by keeping us on their platform, they're monetizing their ads, and that's why they want us, not because they want us to have a happy ending. But yeah, I think the amount of data that's out there possibly is a horse's bolted for us older folks, as Michael says. But maybe we can get the younger ones. Maybe we can convince them to keep a bit of mystery in their online world.
What do you think, Michael?
Look, I have this conversation with my students in my ethics class as well, and it's really interesting to speak to young people about this because you're right. Facebook collects a lot of data about us, and they use that data to work out, to make associations, to work out how many kids I have or how many pets I have or when I tend to get home from work or all sorts of other things, what kinds of events I enjoy. And as older people, we worry about those kinds of things. But when I talk to the younger people, they actually often value the convenience of it and don't worry so much about the privacy part. So they're like, okay, well, you know, Facebook knows that I went and saw Oasis and that I'm a big fan of bands from the 90s, right? That's okay. That's okay. And if it helps it to match me, in this case, going back to the dating thing, with somebody else who's a massive fan of Oasis and bands from the 90s, that's a good thing. And I don't mind them infringing on my privacy if I get that convenience factor. It's the older people that sometimes worry about it a little bit more.
Yeah, I agree. And I think one of the best use cases, I actually heard about some of the recommender systems with companies like Amazon. It's not the "you bought this last week," it's the "you haven't bought a toothbrush in 3 months. How's about you buy a toothbrush?" Mm. Or "this time last year, you bought a happy birthday, mother-in-law" card. And, you know, it's those extra cases where, yeah, we can offload some of that cognitive load. And I think I'm probably on the cusp of that generation where I can see the utility. I also don't want to be subject to it. Like, there's digital toothbrushes that can show your dentist, if they get hold of it, how well you brush your teeth. I do not want my dentist having that. However, I do want it for my children. So, you know, it's that, which hat have I got on? And I think that's what makes ethic classrooms so much fun, because you can kind of play both sides of the coin. But yeah, when it comes down to dating preferences, I think there's also that liability in there, right? I mean, it's not only like who's responsible when the you know, the car actually is being autonomously driven, but who's responsible if Facebook recommends to you someone who ends up doing something terrible? Mm. That's a real concern, and that would come out of the data. And what data are they recommending? So I once read somewhere that, you know, people don't put on their profile or their dating profile that they might have a DV order on them. So, you know, it really is this rosy picture that they are seeing, even though they do have a decent amount of data on us.
Lots to think about, but unfortunately that's all the time we have for this episode of Download This Show. A big thank you to Erica Mealy. Where can people find you?
Oh, generally floating around online. If you look up Erica and UniSC, you'll find me in lots of places.
And a big thank you to Michael Cowling. Where can people find you?
Look, the easiest thing is to go to www.michaelacowling.com, and all of my links are there on a fancy little link tree.
Perfect. And thank you all for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please tell a friend, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, drop us a rating, and consider sharing this episode with someone you think might benefit from it. I'm Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.